Why should it seem important to note the tenderness of Jesus' love? Welcome to The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson, and with me today are Paul Dibdahl and Larry Waverka, all three of us from the School of Theology at Walla Walla University. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Our theme today is the tenderness of His love. Now, I want to press that question. Why would we want to highlight the tenderness of Jesus' love? Does that imply that, as often perceived, God is something less than tender?
Well, certainly love can be expressed in a variety of ways, and it sometimes would be expressed in more, stern?
You're thinking of tough love?
A tough love was actually the phrase that I was trying to think of, yes. So I think it's important to note that God isn't just a God of tough love, but that we have a multitude of examples of the tenderness and the compassion of God's love.
Well, even tough love, I think, for it to be effective, has to have that tender, compassionate quality underlying it. It just adds an element of courage enough to insist that it be expressed and understood and followed through in some way.
Well, that the very comparison of love with its, I mean, what would be the opposite of love?
Apathy?
Self-absorption, narcissism.
If you think of love as a motivating one, I'm thinking of here of Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, where he's coming down to the people and says, which would you prefer? Shall I come to you with stick or with love, the spirit of gentleness? So in that case, the stick is the harder hand, and love implies typically a more gentle approach. Ellen White has this remarkable quotation a few times where she talks about a cruel kindness, which is really quite intriguing. In other words, when people need something more rigorous, you let them off the hook with a cruel kindness.
Well, we call that enabling in today's language.
Today's language, Okay. But come back to my question. Does God have a reputation for being less than tender? Is that why those who prepared the basic study guide here have taken a whole lesson to talk about the tenderness of Jesus' love?
Sure. I think that God does have the reputation of being less than tender.
Okay. Did Jesus come to correct that reputation?
Yes.
Thank you, Larry. That was clear. Then why did God give that impression in the first place?
Well, I'm not so sure that that was an intentional impression that God has given. I think of the rescue of the Israelites at the Red Sea. A lot of it has to do with perspective on what side you are of God's rather singular and loving acts. I mean, the people who stood on the other bank sang hymns of praise and gratitude for God's love that saved them from the Egyptian horde that was pursuing them. But the Egyptians, on the other hand, saw God as being really heavy-handed and harsh to do the things that he did, you know, to them. A lot of it is a matter of perspective. Where you stand in reference to a singular loving act, you can see it very differently.
Well, one of the most common descriptions of God in the Old Testament is compassionate, gracious, slow to anger, abounding in love. That sounds pretty tender to
me. Who will by no means clear the guilty?
Okay. There's the tough love side of it, right?
Yeah. And often, I mean, for instance, when Ellen White quotes that passage in Steps to Christ, she deliberately stops short. And we have a perfect right to do that. You don't need to tell everything to everybody at all times. If you have a very gentle child, you will shape that message very carefully. And if you have one who's got a thick skull, you will shape that message with a little more vigor and enthusiasm. See? And there's a great line from Deborah Tannen in Communications who says, treating people the same is not equal treatment if the people are not the same.
Mm-hmm.
So the diversity in Scripture, the diversity of methods, is exactly what we need, and we don't expect to have just one size fits all. Let me come to a question now. Jesus' compassion for sinners, because The reputation of the Old Testament God is pretty sobering, and there is some pretty heavy-handed stuff there. But one intriguing thing is that there is no record anywhere in the Old Testament of anyone being put to death for adultery. Now, the death penalty is specified for each one of the Ten Commandments, except the last one in the additional laws. But the actual way in which these are fulfilled in the historical narratives is pretty spotty. You do have the famous case of where a man was commanded to be stoned to death for picking up sticks on the Sabbath. But many of those laws in the Old Testament, I'm convinced, are like the signs that we used to have, $10,000 fine for littering. It was so outrageously high that no judge would ever think in terms of doing that. But it still kind of gave the impression, well, they're pretty serious here about littering. They must think that's really important. See? So, but when you come to Jesus' attitudes towards sinner, you have this remarkable story in John 8, the story of the adulterous woman. That seems to contrast with some of the more rigorous attitudes towards sinners in the Old Testament. Would you like to give me some corrective commentary on that observation?
Oh, boy. You're the Old Testament scholar, Alden, so I don't like to tangle with you on this issue.
But this is a New Testament story,
but,
so you can tell me
what
the New Testament
means. Well, I wanted to
means.
Say something about the Old Testament, though. The thing that struck me, and I realize that others may have even the opposite reaction, but the further away I was from the Old Testament, the more scary, frightening, violent, hard-nosed God seemed. I had a class, and I've shared this with you before, I think, Alden. I had a class that I took at the seminary, which required me to read not quite the entire Old Testament, but huge portions of the Old Testament in a compressed amount of time. And to make a long story short, when I did that, the thing that I was left with was God's incredible patience with people, his long suffering, his kindness, his tenderness, the way in which he reached out to them where they were, communicated with them in ways that they could understand. So I know that, I mean, I recognize that the Old Testament and the New Testament, there is a different flavor there, but I don't see quite this huge distinction between the way God deals with the adulterous woman in John 8. Well, I could talk about Rahab, who's a prostitute and not one of God's people. Incredible mercy shown to her and her entire family. They're all saved. She's in the lineage of David and of Jesus. Mm-hmm. That's an Old Testament story. So I'm not...
Well, I would affirm absolutely that it's the same God.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that's different is the people that he's different with. It's the God, the same God, but he's dealing with people in a different way. But still at a superficial level, not just a superficial level, there's some stuff in the Old Testament that's pretty hard to read devotionally. See? Okay. In fact, I'm in the process right now. My wife and I have a very interesting procedure, which I'm going through reading book by book, the Bible, not necessarily in order as they come, but books of the Bible, and selecting passages to read at mealtime that have devotional import. And there are huge chunks in both Testaments, but especially in the Old Testament.
That you skip, huh?
You have to read a lot before you have something that is of immediate devotional value. And I think, you see, most people, when they read devotionally, they want something that gives them an immediate boost where there is not a huge gulf. When you have to bridge a huge culture gap, it's more difficult for that to be meaningful devotionally. And so that's why people just skip huge chunks of the Bible. But there are some amazing things there in both Testaments. But I still remember at one point, in fact, our girls were young, and I thought they needed more exposure to the Old Testament. And I can still see vividly, we were on the carpet in our girls' bedroom, and I was reading from Joshua. Got to that point where Joshua put his feet, said, put your feet on the necks of these five kings, you know, before they strung them up. And about that point, my wife just spontaneously said, why do we need to read Joshua? I read that once. it was just the kind of thing which was just too much confrontation mm-hmm. for her. Mm-hmm. So there is the impression there, but if you're going to deal with wild people, you're going to have to be wild. That's what you see at Mount Sinai. The people there were scared to death, but they were delighted to be scared. You can kind of see them hiding behind the rocks and say, wow, our God can rock the mountains. Yes. Whoa, turn him loose.
A God of power.
Yeah.
A God of incredible power.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, we don't have a lot of time. Let's go and talk about another case, the tenderness of his love. Jesus' attitude towards children. Do children typically shy away from holy people? Adults do. You mentioned a few weeks ago, Paul, that when you let people know that you're a pastor, all of a sudden people freeze up.
They get nervous.
They get nervous. See. So how do children relate to holy people? Or is holy the wrong word to use? Holy doesn't have a good connotation in our society.
I like a statement made by Peter Marshall in his book, Mr. Jones, Meet the Master. See, I can quote people too, Alden. At any rate, Peter Marshall says, the best judges of character are children and dogs. And if a child or a dog will immediately warm up to you, that has a great deal to say about your quality as a person, your trustworthiness, your safety, I guess.
Yeah.
There's a lot of truth to that, isn't there? Yeah. And boy, I've been in churches where the disciples are still around trying to exclude the kids. You know, don't let them play on the church lawn, or they're having berry fights in the courtyard again, and we've got to get these kids out of here, you know. Instead of seeing that the children of the future church and their experiences in church make the church of tomorrow. It needs to be a place where they find great delight, where they're welcomed, where they meet the neatest people in the world, and they love and want to come back.
Mm-hmm. One of the most amazing things that I know about Jesus and the tenderness of his love and the pureness of his anger is the story in Matthew where he cleanses the temple. And I like that line where Reynolds Price says, when Jesus cleansed the temple, he attacked the furniture, not the people. But the amazing thing was that when he got angry, all the evil people left. But it was the children and the lame, the poor, who came running. Now, normally when people get angry, the children are the first ones to head for the hill.
Yeah.
But when Jesus got angry, the kids came running. That mm-hmm. tells me a great deal about the tenderness of Jesus' love.
Yeah.
But we need to quit. Next week is coming up again, and our topic next week will be the meaning of Jesus' death. Larry and Paul will be with me again. Thank you to Josiah Hackerott for our program engineering, and to each of you for listening in for The Good Word. I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Good Word, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla University and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194. Thanks for listening, and we'll be here next week at this time with Good Word.